Hi, it's Ruth McCauley returning with the second half hour of news from the Decatur area. We'll begin this half hour with some of the funeral listings and death notices that appear in the Decatur Herald and Review for Thursday, December 17th. Carolyn S. Borchardt, 69, of Decatur, passed away on Monday, December 14th, in St. Mary's Hospital. A memorial service to celebrate Carolyn's life will be held at 6 p.m. Friday, that's tomorrow, December 18th, at Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home. The family would like to give special thanks to Diane Sims and Ella Ferris for all their support and care. The family of Carolyn S. Borchardt is being served by Moran and Goebel Funeral Home and cremation services on Monroe Street in Decatur. Jacqueline Jill Oliver, age 77, passed away peacefully at Maplewood Nursing Home in Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin. Services will be held on Saturday, December 19th at 6 p.m. at the American Legion Hall, 1535 Legion Drive in Decatur. Sharon Knowles, 73, of Decatur, formerly of Warrensburg, passed away on Sunday, December 13th in Symphony of Lincoln. No services are planned. Arrangements are being handled by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on Oakland Avenue in Decatur. Dolores C. Klein, 93, of Decatur, passed away on Monday, December 14th, in Hickory Point Christian Village, surrounded by her family. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, that's tomorrow, December 18th, at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Our Lady of Lourdes School or to an organization of the donor's choice. Family of Dolores C. Klein is being served by Moran and Goebel Funeral Home and Cremation Services on Monroe Street in Decatur. Gladys Kuntz, 65, of Springfield, died at 3:11 p.m. Sunday, December 13th, at Heartland Nursing Home in Peoria. Visitation will be held this evening from 4 to 6 p.m., Thursday, December 17th, at Ellinger, Kuhns, and Park Funeral Home. There will be a memorial service at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, December 18th, at the funeral home. Memorial donations can be made to the ALSA, all caps there, ALSA, Chicago chapter that serves Central Illinois. Wilson Park Funeral Home, 200 East Main Street in Rochester, Illinois, is in charge of the arrangements. Richard Lewis Dick Krinsky, 79, of Altamont, formerly of Shelbyville, died at 11:26 a.m. on Tuesday, December 15th, in his residence. Graveside services will be held later in Old Rust Township Cemetery near Lakefield, Minnesota, with the Reverend David Natsky officiating. Arrangements are being handled by Howe and Yockey Funeral Home in Shelbyville. Memorials can be given to the Northeast Community Fund, Decatur, Illinois, International Social Service, USA, so that's capital I, all caps, ISS-USA, in Baltimore, Maryland, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, LIRS, also in Baltimore, or Lutheran World Relief, again, Baltimore. Funerals that occurred today include Margaret Ann Bilieu 75 of Moequa at 11 a.m. in Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home in Blue Mound. Terry Alvin Miller, 59 of Sullivan at 1:30 p.m. in Monticello Township Cemetery. James Edward Elliott, 41 of Southern Pines, North Carolina, formerly of Lovington, died on December 11th. Macon County Honor Guard will provide military rites at 5855 Lakeland Drive in Macon, Illinois, on Saturday, December 19th at 2 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made in memory of James E. Elliott to the family or to www.gofundme.com/ZDEKTRPG. Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on Oakland Avenue in Decatur is assisting the family with the arrangements. We turn now to the opinions page and begin with the editorial in the Decatur Herald and Review. Decatur grapples with building issues. Closing or altering school buildings can be a difficult task. The Decatur School District is facing such a task and is going about solving the problem in a deliberate and open way. The district isn't necessarily looking at constructing any new buildings, but wants to make the most effective use of the facilities we already have. Todd Kovalt, Chief Operational Officer, said at a recent community meeting. A committee of parents, students, staff, and community volunteers called FACES, Facility Advisory Committee for Exceptional Schools, has met several times to work on the options for building use. The renovation of the two high schools has solved the building issues associated with those students, but the district still faces facility challenges. Stephen Decatur Middle School has about 350 students in a building that could hold about 1,000. Garfield Montessori and Johns Hill Magnet Schools are two examples of schools with waiting lists, but limited space. Johns Hill, one of the district's oldest buildings, has limited space and accessibility issues. Also in discussion is whether to adopt a K-8 school model or to continue to have elementary schools and middle schools. Decatur currently has some of each. There is research that indicates students do better in the K-8 environment because adolescent students don't have to change schools in the middle of a difficult time in many of their lives. It can also be difficult for students to adjust to the 2-year middle school because they aren't there long enough to find a comfort level. But some students see switching to middle school as a chance for a new start. At the same time, some parents at a recent community meeting expressed concern about older children and younger children attending school in the same building. Transportation can also be an issue, and some parents expressed concern about their special education students. School buildings also create sentimental attachments, which sometimes stretch beyond practicality. Johns Hill has served the district well, but it has outlived its usefulness. It may well be time to retire that building. We also hope that the district will see this as an opportunity to expand programs that seem to be working. For example, Johns Hill and Garfield Montessori have waiting lists because those schools serve a need for students and parents. Although those programs may not work for everyone, there does seem to be a need for similar programs. As with many educational issues, there may not be the one best answer, but the discussion is a worthy one, and the district should be congratulated for facilitating such conversations. Now here comes the people's opinion. Our first is a letter to the editor signed by Elizabeth Birch of Decatur. The two Decatur public high schools, Eisenhower and MacArthur, are now in the middle of their fifth year enforcing a uniform policy, yet there have been noticeable changes in the policy. The many changes that have occurred each year have caused a lack of enforcement and inconsistencies in the interpretation of the policy itself, which has, in turn, led to confusion among students, staff, and parents. Superintendent Lisa Taylor said the current goal of the high school uniform policy is, quote, to promote school pride and a positive image of both high schools, end quote. The relaxation of the policy rules is meant to increase school pride each year. At the high schools, there are spirit days on a few Fridays where students are allowed to wear a t-shirt or hoodie that clearly shows school pride, such as the mascot or school name. It seems that within the last few years, we have gone from having one of these spirit days a month to having one almost every week. I propose an optional spirit day every day. Students can wear a school-colored polo, as they are allowed right now, or a school spirit shirt that they would wear on a spirit day to school every day. To help communicate what is allowed, I propose that we open the school stores that were built in both buildings during renovations and sell spirit attire that students would be allowed to wear. By changing the dress code, we could promote school pride, individuality, and support our after-school athletics and activities all at the same time. Again, that's a letter to the editor signed by Barbara Birch of Decatur. I'm going to pick up a column that appears routinely, daily, I believe, in the Decatur Herald and Review, or at least on every Thursday. Again, I can't read the columnist's name. I think the last name is Goldberg, and I think this is a national column. But here we go. Why the War on Guns Has Failed. In the wake of the San Bernardino attacks, liberals are in a total panic over guns. The New York Times broke a 95-year precedent to editorialize about gun control on its front page, but the Times seemed restrained compared with the full-on meltdown of the New York Daily News, which has taken to calling the head of the NRA a terrorist. I have no desire to rehash the all-too-familiar debate over whether such policies would have their intended effects or whether they'd pass constitutional muster. Let's just stipulate I am skeptical on both counts. But it is worth contemplating why the gun control movement has been such a complete failure. And it might be constructive to compare the war on guns to a regulatory war liberals actually won. The war on tobacco. For a long time, smoking cigarettes was seen as even more American than owning a gun. Hollywood's golden age is like a celluloid smoking lounge. The opening scene of Casablanca is a close-up of an ashtray with a lit cigarette. The camera pans out and Humphrey Bogart takes a nice long drag. Now cigarettes are so widely reviled that the MPAA includes smoking along with violence and sex in its warning language. There are, of course, a great many reasons why we've seen such a remarkable shift in such a short span of time, though medical science is probably the biggest. But there's another factor that doesn't get its due. Smoking was, until recently, a very bipartisan habit. City mice and country mice alike would walk a mile for a camel. Because non-smokers knew smokers, the war on tobacco could be fought face-to-face in our homes, businesses, movie theaters, planes, trains, and automobiles. But when non-smokers pleaded with their friends and loved ones to give up tobacco, that they at least understood the appeal of smoking. Cigarette America wasn't a foreign country. You can't say the same thing about gun America. My wife grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska, where gun ownership was nearly as common and natural as snow shovel ownership. I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and I never knew anyone who owned a gun. Many urban liberals only hear about guns when they're used in crimes and simply can't imagine why anyone would want one. As a result, they're tone deaf in their arguments. Even worse than the tone deafness is the arrogant condescension. In the 2008 campaign, when Barack Obama tried to explain why some rural voters were not supporting him, he infamously said that it was out of bitterness, a bitterness that caused them to cling to their guns and their religion. Obama has been trying to unring that bell ever since. To urban liberals, guns are like cigarettes, products that, when used as intended, only hurt or kill people, and that are also low-class and crude. The Second Amendment, Washington Post columnist Gene Weingarten wrote, is, quote, "the refuge of bumpkins and yeehaws who like to think they are protecting their homes against imagined swarthy marauders desperate to steal their flea-bitten sofas from their rotting front porches," end quote. Oh my, such smugness doesn't help. But the real reason the war on guns has been such an abysmal failure is that guns and cigarettes aren't alike after all. You can't hunt, or more importantly, defend yourself or your family with a cigarette. That's why, in the wake of San Bernardino, millions of Americans didn't think, "We've got to get rid of guns." They thought, "Maybe I should get one." I know I did. Whoa, that's a thought-provoking editorial. We're turning now to letters to the editor of the Decatur Tribune, and there are a whole bunch of them. We're not going to read them all. We're just going to take a nice sampling. The first is signed by Dave Schnaufer of Decatur, and it carries the headline, "Faber's statement regarding fee for working in Decatur is completely false." Dear editor, I used to see Bill Faber's commercials on TV and wonder who is smarter, him or the horse. After reading his paid advertisement in last week's paper, I'm convinced it's the horse. His statement that his fee for the privilege of working in Decatur does not harm business or individuals is completely false. First, many employers in the city of Decatur do not remit any sales tax to the city and will have to start documenting, collecting, and remitting this new fee, hence another new burden to the business. Second, to a part-time minimum wage worker at a fast food restaurant, for example, $3 to $5 a week could very well be a meal, not just a cup of coffee or a soda. Third, it will ultimately drive business and citizens to relocate outside the area where the fee will be imposed. I think the fee will not be imposed. Decatur seems to be doing a great job of driving away business, employment, and citizens already. It really doesn't need to do more in that regard. However, I do have a proposal to generate income for the city. I propose a new fee on legal services in Decatur. In the long run, I'm sure it will generate much more than the $3 million bills for the privilege of working in Decatur fee will produce. Since dislike of lawyers is almost as high as dislike of politicians, I'm sure my legal services fee is something that most all of us can agree upon. That is, if the lawyers don't all relocate their offices to Long Creek, Mount Zion, or in Forsyth to avoid the fee. Let's just try it for 3 years and see how well it works. In my view, it's worth the risk. What do we have to lose? A letter to the editor signed by Dave Schnaufer of Decatur. Our next letter is signed by State Representative Bill Mitchell of Forsyth. It carries the headline, "Evidence shows that gun control doesn't prevent cowardly attacks." Dear editor, The recent terrorist attacks in San Bernardino, California, as well as similar terrorist attacks in Paris, has predictably led President Obama and his liberal allies to call for more gun control. These cowardly attacks were perpetrated by radical Islamic terrorists tied to ISIS. Taking guns away from law-abiding Americans would not prevent such attacks. In fact, there is considerable evidence that doing so would have the opposite effect. On December 3rd, the Washington Post reported that gun violence in the United States has been on the decline for 20 years, except for high-profile shootings in gun-free zones. During the same time period, gun ownership has dramatically risen, but gun homicides have decreased, except in gun-free zones. The Post concluded that increases in gun ownership correlated with drastic reductions in firearm-related homicides, but creating zones where law-abiding citizens are denied the ability to be armed for self-defense has allowed mass murderers to find easy unarmed targets. I am a strong supporter of our Second Amendment rights and am proud to have co-sponsored Illinois' concealed carry law. Our citizens have the right to protect themselves from violent criminals. The courts have repeatedly reaffirmed these rights. In 2008's Heller decision, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized gun ownership as an individual right. In 2010, the Supreme Court overturned Chicago's longstanding gun ban. And in 2012, the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals struck down Illinois' ban on concealed carry. Gun violence is a tragic crime, whether it is Islamic terrorists murdering people in California and Paris, or gangbangers shooting innocent children in Chicago. However, the evidence shows that taking guns away from law-abiding citizens only makes our citizens easy targets for these murderers. Our founding fathers had it correct. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the rights of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Again, a letter to the editor signed by State Representative Bill Mitchell of Forsyth. Our next is signed by John Mark Mattson of Medford, Oregon, and it carries the headline, "Despite the Attacks, Hope Springs Eternal." Dear editor, hope springs eternal, as the old saying goes, and it's true, even with the frightening events in our world of 2015. For example, look at the recent extremist attacks in Paris, France, just one among many today. And then the increased frequency of earthquakes being experienced worldwide, thousands now each year, as compared to about 300 per year 100 years ago, like the devastation this past year in Nepal. Holy Scripture says, "There will be signs upon the earth, distress of nations, men fainting for fear, for things that are coming." But then hope is assured, as St. Luke continues, "When these things begin to come to pass, look up, your redemption is at hand. And lastly, watch then, praying all the time, that you may be accounted worthy to stand before the Son of Man." End quote. Peace on earth and goodwill to all. An interesting letter to the editor, written, signed by a John Mark Mattson of Medford, Oregon. Okay, one more shot at this. A letter signed by Roger German of Decatur. Dear editor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics' third quarter report showed American citizens lost jobs while foreign worker immigrants experienced job gains. According to the BLS, foreign-born worker numbers increased by 14,000, while those for American citizens fell by 262,000. During the third quarter, the job numbers for American citizens has dropped nearly 1 million. The good news is that the economy produced over 200,000 jobs in November. Problem is, the numbers also show American citizen workers didn't get those jobs. The BLS reports that American citizen workers lost 326,000 jobs in November. During the same period, foreign workers gained 375,000 jobs. The Obama administration is obviously working overtime to help greedy corporations give good-paying jobs that were held by Americans to foreign guest workers. It's obvious the federal government is not a friend to the American worker. This betrayal is inexcusable and traitorous. To add insult to injury, GOP leaders are preparing an appropriation bill for a vote, possibly this week, and some GOP legislators want to include a rider that could allow employers to replace at least 100,000 blue-collar Americans and possibly up to 264,000 foreign temporary H-2B workers, temporary foreign workers that never seem to leave. With well over 50 million working-age, able-bodied citizens not working, this legislation, if passed, would substantially increase the number of foreign workers allowed in the United States. This policy by the federal government is out of touch with reality and is unfair to American workers, and the feds use our tax dollars to do it. Where are our congressmen on this? Representative Rodney Davis, Senator Mark Kirk, and Senator Dick Durbin are doing nothing to rectify this problem. We shouldn't have to tell our congressmen American workers come first. If you thought the federal government was your friend, think again, unless you count backstabbers as friends. Well, we built up steam in that one, and that letter is signed by Roger German of Decatur. And we are about out of time for today's news in the Decatur area for Thursday, December 17th. It's been a pleasure reading with you. I'm not sure whether we'll be reading on next week. Next Thursday is Christmas Eve, but hope to be reading with you again real soon. State funding is threatening the existence of Radio Reader, and I understand there may be a closure here January 1 because of a lack of a state budget and money to keep the service going. We'll know more in the new year. It's been a pleasure, and I hope to be back again with you all real soon. Until then, you all have a wonderful holiday season, and you take care.